It's time for Sweet Home Cannabama, a show that'll answer all your questions, provide accurate information, and dispel the myths of CBD. You can participate and have your specific questions answered by emailing sweethomecannabama.com. And now for all things cannabis in Alabama, here's your host, Jennifer Boozer.
Welcome to the show, everybody. I'm Jennifer Boozer, your host. I'm the owner and founder of Cannabama, the CBD store here in Mobile. We're located at 558 St. Francis Street in downtown. Our phone number is 251-255-5155. There's so many fives, I always get tongue-tied. Yeah. And our website, which is being completely rebuilt, you know, all new, is cannabama.com. It's currently unpublished because we are improving it. We decided to scrap the whole thing because,
Very unorganized.
It was pretty garbage. So as far as functionality, it looked beautiful. Didn't really work that good. So we're having that rebuilt. But if you need anything, call us 251-255-5155. And, of course, come down to the store and see us, and we'll be happy to help you. We will be taking orders by phone until the website's back up. So if you need anything, call the store. You can Google us and get that information. Also on Facebook and Instagram. Tonight I have Isaiah, my son Isaiah, with me on the show. Welcome, Isaiah.
Hey, everybody.
We're going to do something a little different today. I'm sure some of you that are listeners that follow us on Facebook may have seen my post, and it's a really difficult subject for me, but today is my son Elijah's birthday, and I'm just going to start by reading my post because I woke up early this morning with an elephant on my chest, and I typed out how I was, you know, feeling and thinking, and to create an honorable memorial for him every year is a difficult thing for me. But anyway, so I'm going to read the Facebook post for those of you who didn't read it, and then we'll kind of go from there. But today we're going to honor my son. On this day, June 13th, 2003, at 4:22 a.m., I gave birth to this beautiful little boy named Elijah Maximus. I was 25 years old and found myself in an operating room bleeding to death myself when my precious son was cut from my body, a horrific shade of blue and barely alive from oxygen deprivation. After my uterus and bladder were ruptured and he went without oxygen from the umbilical cord for 17 minutes. As I lay unconscious in emergency surgery, he was put on a ventilator and whisked away to a hospital with a proper NICU 45 minutes away. My baby boy, 9 pounds, 1 ounce, 22 and a half inches long with a head full of black hair, was brain dead. He lived for 5 days. I held him, barely able to bear his weight, when we took him off of life support and waited for his tiny heart to stop beating. The following autopsy proved he was perfectly healthy until my uterus was ruptured, and negligence by the hospital staff was the reason I would soon be laying my boy in a hole in the ground inside a tiny white casket, forever changing me to my core and setting into motion more pain, guilt, and sorrow than one mother should ever have to bear. Today, he should be turning 19. A man by government standards. I never rocked him to sleep in the middle of the night, never changed a diaper, never got to love him, teach him, guide him. I never got to look him in the eyes and tell him how I'd rather have died that day than live without him. There was no t-ball or band practice or science fair wins, no silly photos or funny stories. I never wished him good luck on the first day of school, never took him to get his driver's license. There was no prom or graduation day for him. I will never hear his voice say, "I love you, Mama." I pray he somehow knew he was loved and wanted very much. Each year on Elijah's birthday, we celebrate the life he did live, however short and painful, because he was my perfect, innocent boy. He deserves to be remembered. We have dinner and cake, and we talk about him. Isaiah was not quite 2 years old when Elijah was born, and Bella wouldn't come along for another 4 years. They have a brother who would have adored them both. Although neither has any memory of it, His tragic death has affected every aspect of our lives. So this year, I'm choosing to honor him by telling our story along with Isaiah on the show tonight. His life was the catalyst that brought me to exactly where I am today, where we all are. I'm going to pour out his story in hopes that we will continue to heal and live our lives in such a way that keeps his memory alive, and hopefully to help others who have lost children, people who are hopeless, those who have lost their way, drowned by grief and all that it entails. So, if you are praying, people, pray for us. This is going to be a hard show, but this story deserves to be told.
So, after he passed away, what happened next?
Well, it was a violent death because, you know, if I can go back a little bit, I was in labor for 44 hours, induced, and there was no way my body was going to allow that giant child to come out without surgical intervention, and I didn't know that, of course. And in the course of pushing on me, trying to force him out, they literally ruptured my insides. So there's me bleeding to death and screaming, God, please don't abandon me. What's wrong? Jesus, help me. While my parents pushed the gurney that I was on down to the OR. It was 4 a.m. in a small hospital. There was no OR staff there. And nobody would tell me anything. I just remember lying there. They strap you down like a crucifix style. Mm-hmm. Your arms are strapped, you know, and there's... Apparently, they couldn't... There was nothing to pull him out of because my uterus was cut in half. Mm-hmm. And I remember there being a grown man on my chest because later on, I felt like my ribs were broken. And they weren't. They were bruised. But I can remember, you know, and just panicking. And I remember looking up at my OBGYN. And she had just pulled him out, and I saw his little legs hanging over the nurse's arm as she swung around my head to get him to the NICU. And they were navy blue, his legs and his feet. And I kept saying, is he okay? Is he okay? Is he okay? And I looked up at my doctor, and she was weeping. Never a good sign in the emergency room or in the OR. But she was weeping, and she said, I don't know, Jennifer, I don't know. And they put me into a medically induced coma. And for 4 hours, they redid my insides. And miraculously, which, you know, I was 25. She knew that I wanted more children. She saved my uterus, so I was able to have Bella later, which is a miracle. Mm-hmm. But I remember waking up, and my grandparents were in my room, which was weird. Mm-hmm. It was daytime, and Joshua had, my husband, your dad, most people don't know his name, he had gone on to the other hospital to meet with the pediatricians and neonatologists and stuff. And no one would tell me anything, but he's sick. And I remember thinking, well, that's dramatic. But, I mean, I can deal with sick, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm a mom. I can deal with anything. Mm-hmm. And so much pain. Oh, so much pain. But all I cared about was, where's my baby? Where's my boy? When can I see him? Where can I get to him? Mm-hmm. And at first, no doctor at the other hospital would take me on as a patient in order for me to transfer there. And the doctor on call was like, no, she's too unstable. And the neonatologist had already told me, you need to get here as soon as you can. He's not going to live very long. Mm-hmm. She was the only one who would be honest with me. And so my Aunt Donna, who is quite the convincer, she's one of my overbearingly loud Cajun aunts. She is an OB nurse at that hospital, and she found a doctor who would take me on as a patient, and they transferred me so that I could be there at the same hospital as him. And I took the longest, most excruciating 30-mile ambulance ride of my life, holding my guts in with a pillow. And I got to that hospital at like 8:30 in the evening, and they only had 4 hours a day you could visit the NICU. So we got me up to my room right at 9 o'clock, and I was like, put me in the wheelchair. Let's go. Let's go. I needed to lay eyes on him. And, he was so beautiful. He was big and healthy and beautiful, and I couldn't believe that they were telling me there's no way he's going to live. When we come back from the break, we'll keep going. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Welcome back to Sweet Home Canabama. Now with all the information you want about CBD, here's your host, Jennifer Booser.
Welcome back, everybody. We've composed ourselves and we're ready to keep going. Not to say that I might not tear up again, but we're going to do our best. Anyway, so when we ended the first segment, I was just talking about how Elijah was moved to another hospital that had a level 2 NICU. And Phil was asking on the break, why did it involve two different hospitals? But the hospital that he was born at in Louisiana, Lincoln General Hospital in Ruston, Louisiana, because I didn't sign an NDA. Lincoln General Hospital in Ruston, Louisiana is where he was born, and it's a fairly small hospital, especially compared to the giant hospitals we have here in Mobile. There was no USA Children's and Women's or anything like that, but St. Francis Medical Center in Monroe, which is, you know, where our families live, had a level 2 nursery. And so they sent a neonatal ambulance with a whole team, doctors, everybody, ventilator, all that, to pick him up. And it took them about 45. Now, you know, I said he was navy blue when he came out. His heart rate was 34. And if you've ever had a baby, you know, baby's heart rate at birth and in utero is 140 to 160. Mm-hmm. And so, but there was about 17 minutes there, like I said, where he went without oxygen because the breaking of the perfect environment of the uterus doesn't allow for the pressure to push oxygen from the cord to the baby, and they're not out to take a breath. So he literally was underneath the layer of my skin in there with my intestines and organs and just out in my abdominal cavity. And it was 17 minutes without oxygen. And babies can go 5-6 minutes where adults can only go 2 to 3 because their bodies heal so fast. But on the flip side of that, when they pass, they deteriorate very quickly. So anyway, they came and they resuscitated him. It took about 45 minutes of epinephrine and paddles. And, you know, I can't even imagine the continued trauma that his little body went through after having basically smothered inside of me. Mm-hmm. And but they put him on the ambulance and they took him. He was gone, you know, an hour after he was born, you know, at 4:20. So he was gone by 5:30 in the morning. I was in surgery until almost 10 a.m. Mm-hmm. And so 9:30, I think, is when I came out of it, out of the anesthesia. And like I said, my husband was gone to the other hospital because at 10 a.m. every morning they would meet with the parents of the NICU babies. Mm-hmm. The visiting hours there were 9 a.m., 1 p.m., 9 p.m., and 1 a.m. And you had to scrub in and wear a gown and a mask and a hairnet and all that stuff to get one whole hour with your baby. And only the parents and grandparents were, you know, basically allowed in there. And if anyone else wanted to go in, you know, and only two people at a time, if anybody else wanted to go in and see him, we had to give up our time. So over 5 days, I had 20 potential hours to visit with my son. And I wanted my mom and dad to see him. And if I was getting tests run or having something, you know, done, because, again, I was barely alive myself, my dad would go in. My dad's been gone for 12 years. My dad would go in. He was the biggest, toughest, burliest, baseball mitt hand having punch you in your face before speak to you kind of guy. Very protective, but he loved babies. And he would go in the nursery, and he would hold my son and sing to him and make sure that he wasn't alone. And but that was hard. I wanted our family to be able to see him, and you were so little. Mm-hmm. Of course, children under 12 weren't allowed. And so we couldn't ever be together as a family like that. But anyway, that 1 hour a day, I was not going to miss that 1 hour. Mm-hmm. You know, four times a day, I didn't sleep. And they had me on a hormone patch. They had me on a Dilaudid drip, mm-hmm. like a pump. It just never stopped pumping into my body. They had me on Xanax. They had me on so much it would knock out three grown men, and I never slept. I was just vigilant. I was going to be ready, and if something were to happen, and I was convinced, you know, and this touches at the depths of my faith. I was convinced that if I prayed long and hard enough, and I wanted it bad enough, and I got enough people around me to pray hard enough, that God was going to fix him for me. That God would not have given me this child just to take him, you know, and we think that way, and it's very flawed thinking, because he wasn't in that position because God wanted him to be. He was in that position because of the pride and the, I don't know, the callousness, the God complex that so many medical professionals have, that they screwed it up so bad. You know, and we proved it. We proved it beyond the shadow of a doubt. It was one of the quickest medical malpractice cases I'd ever heard of. And it was the quickest one I'd ever heard of. Usually those things take 10, 15 years, you know. And ours was done in 4. And, but, you know, it was just a lot. I just thought, no, God's not going to take him. God's going to deliver him for me. Mm-hmm. Because I love him. I want him. You know, so many women don't want their babies. They kill them. They give them away. They mistreat them. But that's not me, you know. Mm-hmm. And it just wasn't. That was not the plan. And after about 3 days of testing, the ethics committee and a social worker, which was funny, she it was a girl that I went to high school with. Thankfully, I knew her. So that was a comfort. But they came to us and said, look, we know that now that he's not going to live. And you have some options. You can wait and let him die at whatever random time his body gives out. Or the ethics committee in the hospital has met and decided that, you know, all it meets all the requirements for you to remove him from life support and let him pass while you're with him. And so that's what we chose. And the day that we knew we were doing, the fifth day, June 17th, they opened up the NICU visitation all day long to us. And they let any adult that wanted to come through at any time to come and pay their respects and say goodbye. So my aunts and cousins and, you know, some of our friends got to be there and see him. We have some beautiful pictures. Our friend Kevin Beasley, who's a professional photographer, he and his wife were there with us from the beginning, and he took pictures of toenails and fingernails, and, you know, he had this ventilator tube in his mouth all the time. You never could get a photo of his full face until we took him off the life support. But I have all these pictures that I, you know, that most people don't get. And his wife, Amy, went and bought christening gowns and brought them all to the hospital and let me choose which one I wanted. Because everybody knew, you know, that this was coming. And it was just so crushingly heartbreaking. And there was nothing anybody could do. And we had hospital staff would come from all over the hospital to see this giant baby who barely fit in this NICU bed because the babies next to him weighed a pound and they had see-through skin and feet the size of dimes, you know, and they lived. And here's my boy who looks so beautiful, and he was gone. And there was nothing, no medicine, no nothing that could have saved him. So that day we decided on the time, and they let our pastors come in, and my parents and my sisters, his parents, his sisters, and our friend with the camera, and we all came together, and they let us baptize him. And I was in a wheelchair, and I was too weak to hold him by myself. And I had a pillow to prop up my arms. And our pastor, I'll never forget, Andy Hurst, he squatted down next to my chair and used his hand to hold my arms up so that I could hold him. And when they pulled the ventilator out, Kevin got that beautiful photo of his whole face. And it took 4.5 minutes for his little heart to stop beating. It was the longest 4 minutes of my life. And then that's when you finally got to meet him. They put us in a room to the side and let us sit and rock him and let you come in and say goodbye to him as a family. For about 45 minutes, when he turned every color you can imagine, as his blood pooled and his body cooled. And that was the last time I saw my son.
Yeah.
We demanded an autopsy because we knew everything that had happened was wrong. And we wanted answers. And they didn't want to do it. But we insisted. And it just proved what we already knew, that he should be here now. He should have had a normal, healthy life. But his body was so burned up from the hypoxia that happens when you are deprived of oxygen, it turns your blood to literally to acid. And we had known your Aunt Annette. They had a friend whose baby had died at like 3 months old, and they donated all of his organs and saved a few babies. And so, of course, then we wanted to do that, but his body was so damaged that we couldn't even donate the retinas in his eyes.
Yeah.
And so we had to wait 5 days to get him back so that we could bury him. And we buried him June 21st in a tiny... We couldn't even afford a funeral or a plot. We were so young. We'd been married 3.5 years. Mm-hmm. My grandparents had an extra plot at the cemetery. And your godfather, Justin, paid for a funeral upgrade and a better casket than just a plain box. And I remember sitting there in a wheelchair, and all I wanted to do was fall into the hole with him so he wouldn't be alone. But I had you. Mm-hmm. And so many other times since then, having you is what kept me on this side of the dirt. When we come back, we'll talk about what happened after that. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Welcome back to Sweet Home Cannabama. Now with all the information you want about CBD, here's your host, Jennifer Boozer.
Welcome back, everybody. Today we're honoring the life of my son, Elijah Maximus, who was born June 13th, 2003, and died just 5 days later after being removed from life support. I almost said child support. Yep. Anyway, so you gotta laugh or you gotta cry, you know. It is what it is. I think laughter has saved me from a lot. Anyway, so what were we talking about? I mean, you know, the funeral was. Well, we probably had 250 people show up for the funeral. My family came from all over. And it was. One negative thing I have to bring up, because it was part of what made me so angry and so bitter for so long, is that, you know, along with the hospital staff and the CEO lying through their teeth to try to get out of a crappy little lawsuit in Louisiana, when you have a wrongful death or malpractice case, there's a $500,000 cap. So, you know, we knew that the most damage we were going to do as far as justice is concerned, which doesn't exist in this situation, was $500,000 that we knew 40% would go to the lawyer. You know what I mean? There's like, you want these people to feel the pain. that they have inflicted on you. This is a whole life. And it's also my life, your father's life, your life, Bella's life. Mm-hmm. Everyone around us was affected. And it's just insulting that there's no one went to jail.
Mm-hmm.
No one lost their job,
mm-hmm.
you know. But at the funeral, I'll never forget my nurse, who was the one who made all the calls that caused it. She came to the funeral. And at the time, I didn't know what I know now, what I would soon learn. I just, you know, I was broken, and it was, you know, a week later. But she came to the funeral, and she wept with me. And as if she had this great compassion, and now I know, it wasn't compassion for me. She felt guilt. She was young, you know, late 20s, hadn't had children of her own yet. And I often wonder if she went on and had children and if she ever thinks about me, if thinks about your brother and wonders, you know, what became of us, because her decisions that day, more than anyone else involved, set this course for us, you know. And, mm-hmm. and she took everything from me. And then the hospital staff, especially the CEO, Tom Stone, they tried their hardest to sweep it under the rug and cover it up as if it did not matter.
Mm-hmm.
And that, whoa, that will make any loving person, because I'm a loving person, I am, but that will make any person just enraged and furious.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like I feel like I can sort of get a glimpse of what parents whose children are murder victims go through when their killer is not caught, because my OBGYN later told me that it would not have been any different if he had come out alive and whole and they had strangled him between my knees. Mm-hmm. It was completely preventable, completely unnecessary, and horrifically malpractice. Like, it was negligence to an extreme degree. So that was hard. But I, in the moment at the funeral, in a wheelchair, on drugs that I can't even remember what I was on, with a catheter bag because my bladder had been destroyed. And, you know, just the impossibility that I was facing of having to put him in the ground, this woman stood in front of me and wept as if she were grieving. And I later, when I realized her role and what should and should not have happened, that has always been one of the hardest parts for me to cope with, is that she got to go on that day, go home, and decide whether or not she would have children or not, or whatever, but she didn't have that hanging over her and bulldozing through her life. And she got away with it. And you know, I still struggle with feeling like, you know, I know one day she'll answer for it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I really know to say about it. But anyway, I don't want to concentrate on that. But after that, you know, I was in a drug-induced fog for a month easy. And I couldn't shower by myself. You know, they had to bind my breasts so the milk wouldn't come in. And because of the bruise of my ribs hurt so badly, the binding took my breath away, and I couldn't do it. So I would stand in the shower, and my mom would have to shower me, which is super humiliating, and stand there and weep because the hot water would make the milk leak and relieve the pressure, and it hurt so bad. I would just cry, and of course it reminded me of all that I had lost. And at night, in the middle of the night, I started not being able to sleep at night because my arms would literally ache. Like, my body knew I should be holding my son and feeding him in the middle of the night. Like, when you were a baby, that was our time, you know? Because Dad was asleep and there was nothing going on and it was quiet, and I would sing to you and rock you back to sleep and feed you. And I was supposed to be doing that with your brother, and I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And my body was really not handling it well. And so I started only being able to sleep once the sun came up. And luckily, I didn't work. Mm-hmm. And I kind of trained you to sleep from midnight to noon. So I could sleep from like 5 a.m. to noon. And that's just kind of how we lived our life. I had insomnia for 14 years. Mm-hmm. But about 6 months later, you know, I, of course, was on tons of pain pills and medicine. But I put that down and it was over and done. And for months, you know, I didn't, you know, it was no big deal. And I've told versions of this on the show many, many times about my addiction. But several months in, I hurt my neck. And let me back up by saying that I am not, obviously, you guys that listen to me regularly, I'm a sharer. I'm a verbalizer. If I'm in pain, I need to say out loud, I am in pain. It makes me feel better. So I needed to get the grief out. I needed to talk about him. Everyone's life had moved on. You know, your dad went back to work after that week. And, you know, everybody went back to their lives. And then, of course, there's the awkwardness that other people feel because they don't know how to deal with you. You know, it wasn't like a weeping bag of emotions all the time. But people knew that that was right below the surface. And they would look at me like I was going to burst into flames. I was 25. So my sisters, my friends, my church family, lots of people that I interacted with regularly were having babies or getting pregnant. No one wanted to tell me that. No one wanted to share that with me because they thought it would upset me. And I had to start saying, look, your baby doesn't upset me. My baby is. You know, does it remind me? Yes. But I don't want you to dampen your happiness because you're trying to avoid hurting me. Mm-hmm. It doesn't hurt me that you're going to have a baby.
Yeah.
It only hurts that I lost mine. And so... I apologize, y'all. I'm a little bit sniffly over here. I hurt my neck. You know, I couldn't share with anybody. I felt guilty sharing with people. And even your dad is the opposite of me. He holds things in. He doesn't share them. He, you know, keeps it to himself. And I so desperately wanted us to be able to share. I wanted to know every detail of what his perspective was, how he felt. I needed to know that he was in pain too. And that was very difficult for him to do. And so I felt so lonely because I felt like, and I knew in my intellectual mind, I'm not the only woman who's ever buried a child. But in that time, it felt that way. It felt like there's not a single person that can understand how I feel right now. I didn't know anyone.
Yeah, personally.
I didn't know anyone personally. And to my friends that are maybe listening that have gone down that road that I met after the fact, I know you know that you guys are probably my favorite because I wouldn't wish that on anyone. But man, it is so much comfort to be able to just look at someone and not even have to say, and they know, you know. And I needed that with your dad, and we just never could get there. But I hurt my neck, and they gave me pain pills for it. And this constant scream that felt like it was building in my chest, needing to get it out so bad, but not wanting to be a burden. It just stopped. It got quiet. Mm-hmm. My head stopped spinning. My heart didn't feel like it was going to burst. My chest felt lighter. I could take a full breath and I could be normal. Mm-hmm. And that was the beginning of the end. When we come back, we'll finish the show with that. The devastation of sinking into addiction due to my grief, the need to be numb. That almost killed me and almost destroyed everything. That is the unintended consequence of all that happened. Mm-hmm. And all that would happen. Facing the fact that we may never have any other children. You know, I mean, all those things happen. And I didn't know back in 2003 there was no opioid crisis. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know you could be a drug addict with something from your doctor. I just knew that when I needed it, I could take it, and it just went quiet. But when we come back, we'll finish up the show. Thank you again for being with us on this difficult day.
Back to Sweet Home Canabama. Now with all the information you want about CBD, here's your host, Jennifer Booser.
Welcome back, everybody, to the final segment of Sweet Home Canabama tonight. We're honoring the life and death of my son, Elijah Maximus Booser, who was born and lived 5 days and died in 2003 and shaped our lives and brought us to this point. You know, everything happens for a reason. I hate that saying, but there is some truth in it. Just don't say that to someone who is freshly grieving.
Yeah.
Don't say that. Don't say, God must have needed another. No. Mm-mm. No. Don't say that either.
Yeah.
I always tell people, when you feel awkward talking to someone who is obviously grieving, mm-hmm. there are no words. Just if you say something, say, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And then just be there. You know, cook for them. Just go sit with them. And God help me, let them cry if they need to. Or if they need to take an AK out to the woods and mow down a tree with bullets, let them. I've always wanted to do that.
That would be fun. Yeah.
I feel like it would be really cathartic. But yeah, I mean, there's no secret formula to it. I had some really close friends who just ghosted me. For a long time.
After that?
No visit, no flowers, no funeral, no nothing. Like,
weird.
I just, for 3 months, zero crickets. And that was its own type of painful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had one friend who did that to me, and she and I were incredibly close. And I couldn't understand
it.
And a few months later, she ends up on my doorstep in tears because she was pregnant and not married and didn't know what to do. And I'm like, really? You came to me with that? But being who I am, because I loved her, I took her in and and she ended up having a miscarriage. Mm. But for her, that was a relief, you know? Yeah. And that's another stab in the heart,
mm-hmm.
you know, that, man, why? Why? But anyway, mm-hmm. so I went from taking, we were talking about.
Yeah, what happened? Where were we at? Like, 6 months after the week?
Right. Yeah. Within 5 or 6 months, right, because he was born in June. And so I started taking pain pills just here and there until it became every day. And then it was 3 times a day because that's the nature of these things. Mm-hmm. And by the time I went to a doctor and said, man, I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm sweating. I can't sleep. And I'm in so much pain and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And they're like, you know, you're having drug withdrawal. And I've talked about this 1,000 times on the show, so I'm not trying to be redundant, but that's just, this is where that comes into play. My son had been gone less than 6 months, you know. And so when he said, you're going through withdrawal, I was insulted. I don't do drugs.
Yeah.
And the funny, I always laugh when I say this now, I don't even smoke weed. Which, hello.
Yeah.
Foreshadowing. But it was too late. For me, by then, I didn't care. As long as I could get a prescription,
yeah,
I was good. And it sort of snowballed from there. I never went clubbing. I never didn't party. I didn't have druggy friends.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't go, I didn't leave you.
No, you're always at the house.
I was there.
I couldn't tell.
Well, right.
I couldn't tell until I was probably 12 or 13, and that was when it got really bad.
And that was when I was suicidally depressed.
Yeah.
I just stopped leaving the house. I would take a shower and put on fresh pajamas and come pick you up from school.
Yeah.
Because you went to Christian school and they didn't have a school bus.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you started riding the school bus, that made it a little easier for me. But by then, Bella was in school.
Yeah.
And I had to go pick her up. So at least every day I had to do something.
Yeah.
But I stopped going to functions. I stopped going to church.
Yeah.
I stopped going on field trips. I wanted to die.
Mm-hmm.
I would distract myself with reading and TV and sleeping as much as humanly possible, which, you know, but then you're exhausted all the time.
Yeah.
But every day, you know, because y'all were gone all day, I had the ability to do that. And then when you'd come home from school, I would, you know, you got fed, you got bathed, you know, all that good stuff. I might not have been much more than a zombie as far as emotionally just dead inside. But, that was the one thing that sort of kept me in my place. I wanted to die so bad. But the thought of you and Bella growing up with this idea that I didn't love you enough to mm-hmm. stay alive, it just kept me from just careening off into a ravine somewhere, you know, head on into a bus. I mean, really, seriously, I used to fantasize about it.
Mm-hmm.
It was sick and dark, and again, another level of dark, dark, lonely. And, you know, I didn't know how to stop it. All I knew was, you're going to want this the rest of your life, you know, and you're going to be miserable and there's nothing for you. And I didn't care about a future because I didn't want there to be one. I would have fantasized that I would get cancer or hit by a bus and I could die and no one would be mad at me. Yeah. It was really bad.
Yeah.
And your dad came to me with an ultimatum finally after 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, you know, I need you to find somewhere to get help, or I need you to go live with your mom. And I was not leaving my kids. I knew he would never let me take y'all with me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't blame him. I wouldn't have either. Just because, you know, he took over a lot of the mom role.
He did.
He did. I mean, he
you
did.
You were there.
He did Boy Scouts. He did
grocery
runs. He started cooking sometimes, you know, or picking up food. He did. He filled in those gaps, and he worked.
Yeah.
And he was a wonderful father.
Other than, like, that last two years to 1 year where, like, sometimes you could definitely tell something was up.
Right.
I never noticed anything besides the fact that you were just chilling.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't, you know, I was, like, what, two when Elijah?
It was 6 weeks before your second birthday.
Okay, so I was about two.
Yeah, you turned two 6 weeks later.
Yeah, two to 12 or 13. Yeah.
Well, that was the whole time. I mean, right at the end is when you know, it really got bad. That last year was pretty.
I was in seventh grade when that happened.
Right.
Yeah, it was like Halloween time.
Halloween. Yeah. Yeah, right at the end of your football season. What's that, Bella? Bella's here with us, too. Both of my kids are here. She doesn't want to be on the radio, but now she's whispering to us from across the room. But anyway, God delivered me from that addiction. I got clean, white knuckle style, and 3 weeks later gave it up, and God delivered me from that craving and that addiction, and I have not struggled with it since then. But I was sick.
Mm-hmm.
I had insomnia for 14 years. I had anxiety, depression. I had high blood pressure. I was 37 years old. And I, you know, had migraines, awful PMS, joint pain, and just not being able to sleep for a decade and a half. It does a number on you mentally and physically.
Yeah.
And 3 years into that sobriety is when I found CBD. And within weeks of that, was off all that medication because it was the first time I had consumed something that was not adding to the chaos and gunking up the works even more.
Only helped.
It was flushing all that trauma, all that grief, that anger, all the pills, all of that pain, it was flushing those sources of disease and pain from my body and allowing my body to finally truly start to heal and allowing my brain to start to function normally. And since then, you know, going through our divorce, let's just be honest, going through the divorce with your dad at the same time as the global pandemic that nearly destroyed the business.
Yeah.
I was nutty, and I started being able to become normal again when I changed up my formula and found something else, which was Delta 8, that helped me just block it all out and be human again and let it go. And so at the end of the day, mm-hmm. you know, cannabis couldn't save either of us in the beginning and wouldn't have. He was completely brain damaged. There was nothing there. I wish I thought that maybe it could have, you know, but it couldn't. But now being able to share my story with my customers, including all the ugly parts, and then being able to offer them the solution that helped change and save my life, this is why I'm so passionate about it. So mm-hmm. when you listen to me and I sound like the nutty weed lady from now on, now you know where it comes from. It comes from this deep, intense desire to give other people the deliverance that I was given. Thank you so much. I know this wasn't a normal show, but thank you so much for letting me share my son.
Thank you.
Remember Elijah Maximus Boozer. Good night.